Welcome, welcome, welcome. You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and on tonight's program, Ian Graham Leask talks with Peter Guy about his latest novel, The Ski Jumpers. A writer and former ski jumper faces a terminal diagnosis and decides to take one more leap into a past of soaring flights and broken family bonds. Peter Guy is author of the award-winning novels Safe from the Sea, The Lighthouse, Road Wintering, winner of the Minnesota Book Award, and Northernmost. He teaches the year-long novel writing project at the Loft Literary Center. Then, the last part of the hour, Ian also chats with Curtis DeBerg about his work traveling the world with Hemingway. Hundreds of spectacular new digital images capture the odyssey of the adventurous author's remarkable life. After 40 years as university professor in California, DeBerg retired in 2020 to devote his time to researching Hemingway and traveling the world in his footsteps, an ambitious journey no one had ever before attempted on this epic scale. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Okay, this is Ian Graham Leask here. I'm talking today with Peter Guy about his fifth novel, The Ski Jumpers. Welcome back to Right on Radio, Peter.
Thanks, Ian.
Good to see you again.
Likewise.
Last time we talked, it was for Northernmost, I think, and that was right after you'd won the Minnesota Book Award for Wintering, and now you're trying something completely different with The Ski Jumpers. Very interesting point of view structure you chose there.
I could have made things easier on myself, that's for sure.
I was thinking that, but that's not what authors do, at least good authors. And you're trying to experiment and push yourself forward and try different things. And all the books have had a slightly different point of view structure. Is that correct?
I think so. I mean, I actually, yes, they've all had different, well, not all different, but there have been a variety of strategies employed. I think of it less, I mean, point of view is, of course, one of the most important decisions a writer can make. And I guess in each of my books, I've made the point of view to a certain extent a character, or at least it has an influence on character. The point of view makes the story larger for the character that's living in the novel. And certainly that's true in this novel.
That's a good answer. Let's just give the listeners a little bit of a background on you. The author of the award-winning novels Safe from the Sea, The Lighthouse, Road Wintering, which, as I just said, won the Minnesota Book Award, the last one, Northernmost. And of course, you're teaching that year-long novel writing project at the Loft Literary Center. And Peter Guy is born and raised in Minneapolis, where we're talking from right now, although he's not here, he's on tour, and he continues to live here with his family. Where are you right now, Peter?
I am in Decorah, Iowa. I had to think about it for a second.
That's from the voice of a man who's becoming famous. So you better tell us a little bit about Ski Jumpers before I jump into some of my questions about this.
Sure. So this is a book, and the more I've talked about it, the more memories of writing it have come to me. When I was finishing graduate school in 2008, I had finished my dissertation, which was actually became my first novel, Safe from the Sea. And I was, ready to start another book. And it was this book that I started. I have notebooks dated 2008. And the first inklings and some of the first passages for this book stretch as far back as that. I, of course, well, maybe not of course, but I got sidetracked many times. And I don't know if I got sidetracked as much because I was struggling with the ski jumpers or because I was inclined to write other things. I think it was some combination of them. I had a hard time separating my own experience as a ski jumper from the characters in the book. It was a long process of letting go of my own part in the story, because there is a part of me in this story, unlike in previous books where there's, you know, I mean, maybe glimpses of me, but not the way that it is in this story. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the years since I started this, since 2008, I've just come back to it every now and again and developed it a little bit, thought about it a little bit more, tried to put a little bit of that distance that I just talked about between the story and me. And then finally, when COVID came along, we were all, well, most of us, I think anyway, we were some combination of bored and scared, and the world suddenly looked truly different for the first time, at least in my recollection. And it seemed like a good time to bear down on this book. And I started thinking about some of the things that I wanted to do as a writer. You brought up point of view early in our conversation, and I really thought about who John was and where he was telling this story from. And in bits and pieces, the sort of three-tiered timeline came to me. And once I had it all figured out, which was a process that, well, took many years and then a couple of months, I wrote really quickly, much more quickly than I've ever written before. It took me about 6 months to write the last three quarters of this novel.
That's because you kind of instinctively knew much of it in your heart. It feels to me very memoir-like. Mm-hmm. There's... in our business, you know, we make this distinction between the Romane Clef, which, you know, is a novel about things that actually happened, and, you know, a slight difference with books like James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which we designate as autobiographical fiction. Where do you feel this fits in with those categories?
I think, on the one hand, my life in no way resembles the life of John Bargard. And my brother, who is, you know, certainly an influence on the character of Anton, and my father, who is certainly a character, an influence on the character of Pops, we each bring something to those characters. And I was intentional about wanting to, I don't know, maybe capture their shadow or something like that. My father and my brother's shadow.
Yeah.
And so that part is definitely intentional. The lives that they lead, the things that they do outside of the world of ski jumping are really quite distant from my own life and from the lives of my father and brother.
So although it's feeling like it's a memoir for the character John.
Exactly.
And
yes.
Not so much for you. So right. I think that's one of the things I just wanted to talk about, Dan. People don't usually think about this, but a first person narration in modern literature is a fictional memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And we do well if we think of it that way, to write in such a way as it feels very true to life and very personal. And of course, that's what you've done here. As always, you know, you're very careful about how you produce the internal structure of people's thinking and their behavior. How aware were you of that kind of situation as you were rapidly finishing this up, as you've just stated?
I mean, intensely and positively aware of it. I mean, one of the reasons I think that it took as long as it did to get to John, and one of the reasons that his story came as easily once it did, is because I was figuring out how to occupy his consciousness instead of my own. And I was figuring out how his emotional life would feel to him, not to me. And this is a lesson. I mean, this is kind of basic fiction writing, as far as I'm concerned. Sometimes those lessons are the hardest to learn or apply. And I think, I mean, I don't think, I'm certain that the, one of the reasons that that's true is because the ski jumping parts of the story in this book, and there's a lot of ski jumping, both literally, literally and figuratively in the story, that part is, in many instances, pulled right from my memory bank. So I have imbued John's consciousness with my own memories, for better or for worse. It's a decision that I made, but I wanted to, I didn't want to have to research in the way that I've always researched. I wanted it to be my memories and the some of the experiences that my father and brother and I had together. And so, I brought that to bear on the story. And like I said, when I'm doing that, and because I do that often enough in real life and in my own fond memories and, you know, chewing the fat with my father and brother and friends, those ski jumping memories are pretty imminent in my life. I mean, I keep them pretty close to me. And so there was a process of whatever it is, divestment or making some distance between the two of us. Once I got it though, it was pretty dreamy writing.
No, that's good. Very good to hear. It's very encouraging, I think, for many authors. There are two kinds of ski jumping in this, or let's say just jumping. There's the physical ski jumping itself, which was we'll start off here. And then there's a metaphorical, or just you just said figurative ski jumping, you know, the you're doing lots of jumps in point of view and all sorts of jumping around in a controlled way here, which I found fascinating, and the fusion of the real ski jumping and the figurative ski jumping is what makes literary novels so interesting. But let's talk just about the actual physical ski jumping. You're a big fella. You're kind of like me. You're over 6 foot and you're a heavily boned guy. And I never very really followed ski jumping. It was occasionally Winter Olympics and things. And I always noticed that the athletes in that sport tended to be small and slight. And in your book, Pops, John's father, is small and slight. Didn't get much mention of the size of John and Anton, his brother, that I recall anyway from reading it. But you're a big guy. Explain to us, or disabuse us perhaps, of the cliche that ski jumpers are small.
I wish that I could. I think one of the reasons that I, this sounds like I'm making an excuse for myself. I'm not. One of the reasons I never became an elite ski jumper is because I was one of the big guys. And there were a couple of big guys that in the 80s, when I was coming of age as a jumper, who made, you know, who did become, in fact, international competitors and Olympians. It wasn't, the focus then wasn't as much on, you know, tiny and skinny as it is now. So that's true. It's also true that when I was, you know, 18 years old, though I was 6'2", I was quite a few pounds less than I am now. I worked really hard to stay really skinny.
Yeah.
And that actually is one of the things, I mean, when I look at the course of my life as a ski jumper, one of the things that was incredibly difficult to do, especially at the end when I was aspiring to be an international competitor, was to stay as fit as I did. And it was, you know, it's one thing to, you know, to do your training. It's another thing to do all of your training and have to eat salad for a year at a time in order to stay, skinny, which is really what it came down to. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, salad's terrific. Who doesn't love a good salad? But so sometimes you want a pizza.
Yeah, sometimes you want a steak.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, that was very interesting. And the whole descriptive structure of taking off from such a great height and increasingly greater heights as John gets older was very collective in my thinking as I was reading through this. And My daughter, as a lot of people know, is Ingrid Leeskin. She's a Nordic skier, and just, you know, she was an elite skier, but just a little bit too much of my bone structure to beat Jesse Diggins, you know. And Jesse Diggins is a friend of hers, so I really brought that experience with coaching my daughter, you know, with sports, to this book, and really understood to a great extent what John was going through with his father. I mean, there's times when she didn't want to listen to me. There's times when I was, you know, pushing her on and saying, come on now, you can win this. And she'd give me the finger, you know. It would infuriate her, you know, to be in the middle of that kind of battle and then have to listen to me shouting from the side of the you know, from the snow banks. Mm-hmm. And so I really understood both what you were writing from the character, but also from you, because I, of course, knew that you had been a ski jumper, as we have mutual friends and stuff like that that are in that sport. But then you take that to the next level and start using this figuratively, the leaping that the character John is making. And of course, you make him a novelist. Mm-hmm. And not only a novelist, but a novelist, we find out very early in the book, who is suffering from early onset of Alzheimer's. And it's beginning to show, and he hasn't really told everybody yet. And the structure of the book is that he's doing something you often do in your books, and that's driving up Highway 61 up to Grand Marais, which you
up to Gunflint.
You call it Gunflint, but we all know it's Grand Marais, which I think is lovely. The story unfolds kind of like Chaucer, you know, we're on a journey and we're going to hear different parts of the story. It's lovely. So narrative leaps get made, and I suppose leaps in history, and you hold back a lot of the time the details that he knows in a very novelistic way, holding that back. That must have caused you some doubt as you were moving through that, when to let out information, when to feed that out to the reader, and, you know, so that it doesn't become contrived.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fine art of doing this, is knowing when to convey that information, when to give the increasingly important, and in the case of this book, increasingly ominous and dark details of the past that has divided this family. And this, I mean, the short answer to that question and observation is yes, it was very difficult to know when to tell the story, when to put the words in John's mouth for greatest effect. And when you're telling a story that is mostly memory, whose only forward momentum is this singular day in 2019 when John and his wife are driving up the shore, you have to find the dramatic tension elsewhere. And one of the ways that I found that dramatic tension was by holding back parts of the story. I mean, it's true that one of John's objectives for this day, his main objective for this day, is to tell Ingrid, his wife, about parts of his past that he has yet to tell her, despite their 35-year marriage, despite their very happy and fulfilling relationship with each other. He has kept things from her. And given his diagnosis of the day before of younger onset Alzheimer's, he is convinced that now is the time to do that. And the story that he has to tell her, we can't discuss it because it gives too much of the book away, but it is a dark, it is a serious, it is a criminal admission. And so I'm relying on that to do some of the work of convincing the reader that each page is worth turning, if for no other reason than they want to find out just what happened. So there's that element of the storytelling. There's another element of the storytelling too, though, which sort of fits under the umbrella of, you know, broader topics or broader hopes and expectations for this book, which is that John's experience on this day is recognizable to the reader, or to many readers, to most readers, hopefully, as a sort of experience that we all have. It's the experience of living. So yes, he has this day to look forward to. He's going to visit his daughter in Gunflint. She has some big news for him. He's got plans to tell Ingrid about what's happened. So we get to see them in that very ordinary day making the drive up the shore. But as he's doing that, he's telling her things about his past. He's reflecting on his past, and he's doing that by going back to a couple different epics in his life. And that's how we live. That's how I live. You know, I'm going to get in the car tonight after an event here in Decorah, and I'm going to drive home. And as I drive back to Minneapolis tonight, I'm going to have one eye on the road going forward, getting home. I'm going to have another part of myself looking back at the day, reflecting on this conversation, reflecting on my, you know, whatever happens to cross through my mind, as well as looking forward to what's beyond home and in the days ahead. And John doesn't get what's beyond home, what's in the days ahead, or he's not going to get that for much longer. And that to me is where
because of the Alzheimer's.
Because of the Alzheimer's. Yeah, yeah. Right. Right.
Well, I think you get away. It's interesting that you get away with this because he's, like you, always been wanting to write a novel. And this was the novel he always wanted to write. But as we said earlier in the conversation, it's really a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a confessional memoir. And the member, because you're inventing the memoir, it is this novelistic memoir. And he's feeding the information out to his wife, partly, as you say, in a very realistic and choreographed movement. He's a little afraid of her in mm-hmm. some ways, even though they've been married for a long time. She's quite a strong character. You always write strong women characters, which is appreciated. But I think you sort of leave us with the impression in this book that he's either going to write the book or the book has already been written for him in the conversation. I don't know how intentional that is, but that's how it came across to me at the end. I sort of put it aside and thought, okay, I've got an ambiguity here. I've got a conundrum of my thinking. Is, you know, what I always do when I read books is to try to frame all of it and see how serious the author is about the structure mm-hmm. and about the unity and about the orchestration that's taken place, the verisimilitude. And I was left with that conundrum there, which I liked. I like ambiguity at the end of books. Can you address that?
Yeah, I mean, it became the question of John as the author of a book called The Ski Jumpers became a thing for me to play with. Yeah. And I'll just be perfectly frank about it. I mean, it's a lot of work to write a novel, to write any novel. It was especially a lot of work to write this one. And it felt very serious at times and very, you know, I mean, the dark notes were hitting very close to home in some cases. And I wanted, you know, I wanted elements of play, and that became one. The more I thought about it and the more I let that play stay a part of the story, the more sweeping the gesture came to me. Now, as I understand it, you use the word ambiguity, which is one of my favorite words when it comes to the practice of writing fiction, whether it's narrative ambiguity or moral ambiguity or any of the other kinds of ambiguity that we live with all the time. I want that in my fiction. I mean, I'm actively trying to incorporate ambiguity as an element in the story. I think that it reflects life. I think that most of us are ambiguous characters in our own lives, especially in our private lives. And I welcome all of that and try to recreate all of that. For me, John isn't going to write a book called The Ski Jumpers. John's in effect telling us the story of what would have happened in The Ski Jumpers by discussing his past with Ingrid and reflecting on those memories of his boyhood and his brother and his father. I'm the author of The Ski Jumpers. It says so right on the cover of the book. So it is John's memoir, partly informed by my own memories and experiences as a ski jumper and as a son and a brother, and as a husband for that matter. But it's John's story. I'm taking the story out of John's head and putting it down onto the page. And so it's meant to be playful. It's meant readers are meant to puzzle over this, not because it's I want to vex them, but because I hope that it's as fun for them as it is for me.
Yeah, and it is fun, and it's fun to get into that conundrum in your mind and think, well, here's an author writing a book called The Ski Jumpers, and here's a character that wants to write a book called Ski Jumpers, and he's kind of narrating that book to his wife, and it's I think very successful in that way. As usual, we're running out of time, long before I have all my questions answered, but we'll do that over a beer next time I see you. Real quickly, what's up next? Number six in the works?
Yeah, number six is in the works. It is about halfway done, maybe a little bit more than halfway done. And it won't surprise you at all to hear that it's another book set on the North Shore. It's a historical novel, though, and it's the first of what I imagine probably being five or six books that is a progressively deeper dive into some of the historical moments that define the region. Told through novels and fiction, of course, but that goes back to some of the first European settlers in this part of the country and explore.
Very good. Yeah. I always, when I'm up there, I'm always looking at those early structures that they built, and some of them are still there. Well, I'm really glad that you're writing that book. I love this, and love talking to you as always. And thanks for being back on the show, back on Write on Radio, and good luck with that next book. This is Ian Graham Lee speaking with Peter Guy about The Ski Jumpers.
Thanks,
see you
Ian.
Next time, Peter. Good luck.
Thank you.
Recently, I returned to the Musée d'Orsay and the paintings of Cézanne. I stared at them a long time, studying the thick brush strokes that gave his works the third dimension of depth. Hemingway wanted to write like Cézanne painted, he said, giving more depth to the combinations of words by using fewer of them. Hemingway's own life story has also endured, and his personal story is as good as any of his stories. He achieved his goal of writing in three dimensions. But he and his work endure because he sought excellence in writing and great adventure in living. Hemingway has stood the test of time, not only because of his writing, but because he strived to live a life that made him the hero of his own life story. Hemingway wrote so well, his pencil, his brush, his blue notebooks, his canvas. His words painted pictures of life, struggle, love, blood, bravery, and death. He searched his imagination to produce stories that presented landscapes in readers' minds, vivid, modernist displays of width, height, and depth. Often, he lent readers their own brushes so that they might fill in some of the gaps, consistent with his iceberg theory of writing. Arguably, Hemingway is the foremost American writer of the 20th century, and his stories continue to be read. In this, his literary contributions have added a fourth dimension by enduring from one century to the next. They have stood the test of time. Time, the fourth dimension.
Wow, excellent. That gave me chills. You've just been listening to Curtis L. DeBerg reading from his coffee table book about Hemingway called Traveling the World with Hemingway. This is Ian Graham Leask, and I'm very, very honored to welcome Curtis L. DeBerg to Write on Radio.
Thanks for having me, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm just going to read your little bio that's on the dust flap of this beautiful book. Wow, I can't congratulate you and your publisher enough on this lovely book, Wild River Press. You can see the book if you're near your computers, wildriverpress.com. It's just a beautiful book. So Curtis DeBerg became intrigued with Ernest Hemingway when he first traveled to Key West in 2005 to visit a cousin who owned a vacation home near Geiger Key. After 40 years as a university professor, Dr. DeBerg retired in 2020 to devote his time to researching Hemingway and traveling the world in his footsteps. He is a member of the Hemingway Society, a group connecting scholars and historians who love and promote the work of Ernest Hemingway. It has 600 members worldwide and is one of the largest single author organizations in existence. He is also a group administrator of the active Facebook group Ernest Hemingway, which currently has 28,000 members. So I'm sure he'll be happy if any of our listeners want to join that group. So tell us a little bit about the structure of this lovely book, Kurt.
Right. The structure takes the timeline of his life, actually, and his travel, starting with his birthplace in Oak Park, Illinois, and ending, of course, in Ketchum, Idaho in 1961. And so after I took a sabbatical in the year 2019, and decided to move to Paris for a year, I decided I would do my very best to retrace Hemingway's footsteps during his lifetime. And there's good news with the COVID and bad news. The good news is I got to spend more time in Europe. The bad news is my trip to Cuba and to some of the locations in the US I needed to see were delayed. So like all things in life, Ian, the COVID-19 really disrupted my book, but in many ways it made for a better book because I was able to spend more time in places like Madrid and Bimini, Bahamas, and in Venice, and in Schruns, Austria, and Lausanne, Switzerland. These off the beaten paths that Hemingway traveled, I've actually been to, I'd say 95% of all the places Hemingway has been.
Oh, that's amazing. You know, you sort of have lived a portion of his life by following him like that. And I think one of the things that people loved about him, you know, from the 20s onwards was this this feeling of gaining experience and traveling and doing things that very few other people could or would do. And, you know, it's very nice reading this book. I really, it stayed with me when I was finished. I think because of the propensity of pictures, there's just a ton of photography in this and of all kinds, tremendous variety between old photographs that you've picked up, black and white photographs, and newer ones of him, and then photographs that you took. It's packed, and I really responded to that. I think there was we're so used to seeing everything now on our cell phones, and on video screens and whatnot, that it was lovely to open a book and have everything in one place. Were you thinking about that at all with your publisher when you put this together?
Yes, you know, I was concerned that, you know, coffee table books are, you know, almost passe now, because like you say, if you want to see a picture of Hemingway when he was age 36 living in Key West, you just Google it and you can find all the photos you want. But the reason this book is special to me, and I think it's going to be special to people who decide to go ahead and purchase it, is you can open up the chapter, say, to Paris, and you can immerse yourself in Hemingway, not only during the time he spent in Paris on 74 Cardinal Cardinal Lemoyne, yeah, or Notre Dame des Champs, you can see the photos of what the places look like today.
Yeah.
And so the juxtaposition of time is something that you really can't get unless you're a deep researcher on the internet. Here you can open the chapter to Key West and feel like you're at the Hemingway lookalike contest in July, or you can open the chapter to his time in Europe when he was traveling to Switzerland and Austria skiing with his first and then second wives. So yes, books aren't, you know, hardcover books are still popular. And even coffee table books are not only mementos for something that you could, you know, put on your living room table, but I consider my piece of work here to be as much art as it is authorship of a biography. Yeah. So, the pictures here are of old time photos of Hemingway and current photos that either I took or I hired a professional photographer to take.
Well, it feels like you and your publisher have created something which almost looks like a kind of museum piece. I mean, it's the photographs feel curated. And
thank you. That is exactly what we are going for. Tom Perrow, my publisher at Wild River Press, incidentally, was a friend of John Hemingway, who was Ernest Hemingway's oldest son. And they were fly fishing buddies. Tom, for years, has published hunting and fishing magazines. Now, hunting and fishing magazines have lost market share because people can, like you say, get any information they want really off the internet. But Tom has kind of pivoted from hunting and fishing to more traditional books, but he's really a specialist in what I'd call coffee table books because he's an artist. He has a wonderful eye for laying out the page with not only the text, but also the photos. And I was happy when you introduced the book to say that you were marveled at how taken you were by the pictures. Yeah. And I'm proud of the prose that I've written. And I think the prose should be read. I hope people don't just pick up this book and look at the photos because there are some very interesting stories. And I would point especially to Ernest's time in Italy in World War I, when many people think he was an Italian soldier working for the American allies in Italy. But he was not a soldier, he was a volunteer for the Red Cross.
Yep.
And when he was injured, he was not fighting the enemy, he was delivering chocolate and supplies to the Italian allies who were fighting in the trenches.
Yeah, but he did go up to the front.
Absolutely. Now, whether or not he went up to the front against orders or if he was doing this with orders is another interesting story. Yeah. We'll never know the answer to that, but like all 18-year-olds, he was full of bluster and he was full of vigor and he wanted to see action.
And he saw it, didn't he?
He caught the bad end of a mortar shell, which put about 200 pieces of mortar fragments in his right leg and his knee. And yes, he suffered, but in a way he was lucky because yes, he had a serious leg injury, but it was not life-threatening, nor was it really threatening to lose his leg. So he kind of won the lottery by getting the experience of being in combat without actually being in combat and without actually being seriously wounded.
Yeah, and the man next to him, which you write about really quite beautifully, was killed.
You know, that man's name was Fedele Temporini.
Yeah.
And it's unusual that Hemingway always loved giving, paying tribute to the hero. And the writers, biographers usually refer to these as the Hemingway Code Heroes. And these code heroes are brave and they're courageous under threat of death. And they don't brag about their accomplishments. They let their actions speak for themselves. Well, you would think Hemingway would have given Fedele Temporini some credit for having lost his life in the trenches. And there is one Red Cross report that says Temporini may have intentionally put himself between the mortar bomb and Hemingway, thereby sparing Hemingway's life. So yes, Temporini is a Hemingway code hero. And one of the mysteries is why didn't Hemingway ever give this man the credit that he deserved for paying the ultimate price in war?
Yeah.
And that was Fedele Temporini. And I would love to see a movie about Fedele Temporini actually, and maybe someday there will be one.
We'll have to write that.
Right on.
Let's talk for a moment about you were just talking about how you hoped people will read the prose. I loved reading the prose. You're very informal in the way that you lay out everything here. It's literally like talking to you now. And I found that to be a little unusual, perhaps, for coffee table books, which tends to be a little bit more formal, a little bit more scholarly a lot of the time. But this went beautifully with the character that we know of Hemingway and the ease with which he used the English language. And yours isn't the same as his. You're not really influenced stylistically by him. But what you do is to keep things very simple and clear. There's no messing.
Thank you.
You get straight to the point. It was really a pleasure to read it. And there's not much of it. I mean, it's got a really nice print. It's very easy to read. I mean, I would highly recommend this to all Hemingway aficionados. And this is something that I was quite surprised with, you know, having this. I've got a lot of these books. And as you know, I run Afton Press here in the Twin Cities, and we do quite a few coffee table books, usually about art. So I'm used to them. And this one was different from everything I've ever read before. And that was, I was literally in it. And I loved having the photographs instead of doing it the way we now do it. And it's been ages since I've gone into a book and been completely hauled into it with the prose and the pictorial element. So congratulations on doing that. You caught, I'm like Mikey in that old ad, you know, I hate everything.
Right.
And I really like this, you know, so, you know, well done. I mean, it was.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
You know, I think there's a lot to be said when a writer, a biographer visits the place of the subject that he's studying, because once I have seen, say, the hotel room that he and his first wife Hadley lived in when they first moved to Paris, or when I actually climbed the same stairwell that Hemingway did when he first moved to Paris in the Contrescarpe area. And, you know, for the most part, Ian, I've been very happy with the reviews of the book, but there was one review and one, it was a magazine, actually, a hunting and fishing magazine, where the editor used a term I had never heard before. He referred to me as an academic voyeur. And that, you know, the excitement I have in going to Spain and seeing the hotel room where he started writing A Farewell to Arms. Yes, that gives me a thrill. But that does not make me a voyeur by any means, any more than it makes a biographer or an academic who studies Hemingway and scrutinizes his life and his writing. I mean, everyone who likes Hemingway does so for a different reason. They may do so because they like his stories. They may do so because they like his life story and his He-Man image of the deep sea fisherman and the bullfighter. But to each his own, Ian. If you like Hemingway's writing and his life story, go for it. You know, there's so much to like and appreciate about him without having to like the man. I personally like the man. I think he was tortured. Yeah. He killed himself just before he turned age 62. He became a great writer, I think, because he wanted to experience those things that he wanted to become an expert on. And the only way you can become an expert is through experience.
Yeah, that's right. And it's we share a recent visit to Ketchum. I was there with him a while ago. I think I told you about this when we talked earlier.
Yes.
And it was quite something to stand by that grave. The reason I always liked him was from a very early age when I started reading him was I sensed the damage in a macho type of guy and a very strong man. I sensed the sensitivity behind that, which is very much my dad. My dad had he'd shot a buffalo in India, and he had it over the mantelpiece when I was growing up. It scared the living daylights out of me every time I went in the front room, you know. And but you know, I didn't know. I don't know if he ever read Hemingway or what, but he lived a little bit of this life in India and a little bit of Africa. And
interesting.
As I grew up and started to read Hemingway, my dad was long gone by then. I started to feel this, and I think it You know, my dad was a very, very difficult person and a nightmare in many ways, but there was that sensitivity beneath him, which I think caused depression. And let's talk a little bit about Hemingway's depression. You remind us that he killed himself at the age 62, which is very, very young, and by today's standards anyway. And of course, a lot of people don't know that he was down at the Mayo Clinic here in Minnesota. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. I'll start with the Mayo Clinic. After the book was published, Ian, I wanted to continue, walking in Hemingway's footsteps. So I went to the Mayo Clinic and I actually asked at the information desk if I could talk to maybe someone there that was an archivist that could tell me about Hemingway's stay back in 1960 in the winter. And then he returned in April of 61 for his second visit. And sure enough, there was a 99-year-old nun named Sister Lauren Wynant. And I was introduced to her just last summer. And she knew Hemingway. She was 33 years old when Hemingway was first brought to the hospital suffering from depression. And she said that she was assigned to his ward. And when he was dismissed, Hemingway gave her two gifts. One was a book with his inscription for The Old Man of the Sea, the book. And another one was a little silver Christmas tree that he gave to her. And so I asked her, of course, did she still have this book? And she said, oh yes, it might be somewhere down in the vault. I'll ask one of my assistants to go look for it. Well, the assistant went to look for it. She couldn't find the book inscribed to Sister Lauren, but there was a book inscribed to Sister Immaculata. Ah. And he said, it seems my luck is running good again, or something like that, and that he will soon be able to write well again. And the date on this book was June 15, 1961, which was later than the last known words that Hemingway had ever written. I'm going to pat myself on the back here a little bit. Through my research, I have now uncovered what now seems to be Hemingway's last written words was to a nun at the Mayo Clinic.
Oh, that's fantastic. Did you happen to buy the book off her for $10?
I told the Mayo Clinic that they should get in touch with the Penn State Hemingway Letters Project, led by Professor Sandra Spanier. And in fact, Professor Spanier did reach out to the Mayo Clinic, and they are now in touch with Sister Lauren. I'm not sure if they're going to try to acquire the book for their own archives, their Hemingway archives. But personally, I would love to see this book in the JFK Library and the Hemingway collection there. Because if there's any home that it should belong, if not the Mayo Clinic, it belongs in the Hemingway collection at the best library in the world for Hemingway artifacts.
That's really interesting. Let's just go back for a moment to a part of the story, the Hemingway story and your book, to Paris in the early days when they were together. And this is simply because I've been there too, where he lived on Cardinal Lemon Street in Paris, when I'm in Paris, which is quite often, my other half Sue and I love to go there, and we usually stay down on Rue Mange, which is just an alleyway away from where he lived shortly there. And you write well about that, and had this very interesting little experience with somebody who lived in the building. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. I referred earlier to the fact that I was happy to be able to climb the staircase up to the third floor, apartment number 3. And of course, this is where Hemingway lived with his first wife, Hadley, from January of 1923 until they moved back to Toronto in late 1924, so that Hadley, actually it was 1922, they lived there in 1923, and then they moved to Toronto so they could have their first child, John Hemingway. But I longed to be able to go into the building, climb the staircase, and even knock on the door number 3, which I know was kind of, maybe it's a little bit too aggressive, but ultimately I was having a beer across the street with my French teacher. And the young man that was entering the building must have been in his mid-30s. And she jumped up and she said, "Excuse me, you know, my friend would love to be able to take some photos of the staircase." And he sat down with us and he said, "I live exactly one floor above where Hemingway lived. And by all means, please come in, take as many photos as you'd like." He said, "My wife and I are going out to dinner, or I would invite you up to the my apartment." And so I had like 25, 30 minutes where I could go up the staircase, take some photos. And one thing I wanted to see is whether or not these Turkish toilets still existed on each landing. And of course, the 3rd floor, no, it was no longer there. The 4th floor, no. But the 5th floor had exactly the Turkish toilet that Hemingway had described in his book, A Movable Feast. And so,
but you didn't put a photograph of the toilet in the book.
You know, I think my publisher overruled me on that.
What an old prude. Tell him he's a prude.
I will. But anyway,
I very much wanted to see the Turkish toilet.
Well, maybe you'll have to wait for my next book, Ian.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe that can be the cover of the next book.
The weight of that guilt, if there were such a thing, could have caused him to say, "Look, you know, I've had to live with this lie my entire life. And, you know, for sure, you know, we could conclude that depression, alcoholism, and the concussive head injuries all had an effect on causing early dementia. But there's also the fact that he had maybe some remorse for how he treated his wives. He may have had some remorse for the lies he told about his so-called heroism in World War I. So, no, I don't want to spread a conspiracy theory because I love Hemingway and I love his life story. But after all the work I've done in researching and interviewing scholars in Italy, I think he was in the trenches against orders. And I think he may have even been wielding a weapon, which was against orders as well. And so this young 18-year-old delivery boy, if he caused the death and wounding of Italian soldiers, that could have been, that could have had him wrestling with the gods and could have tormented him his whole life. This young 18-year-old delivery boy.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Peter Guy and Curtis DeBerg, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. You can listen to all of your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and so on. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.